Welcome to KUW Speakers Forum, a place where you can hear intellectuals, authors, artists, and more speak from a variety of venues around Seattle. I'm your guest host, Anna Tadashev. In August of 2010, the world's attention was captured by the 33 Chilean miners trapped 2,300 feet underground at a mining facility located north of Chile's capital, Copiapó. 5 years later, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hector Tobar's new book, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free, unveils the true story of each of the men. 69 days after the cave-in, all 33 miners were successfully rescued from the mountain's depths. While still trapped inside, the miners made a pact they would not individually sell their story for fame or money, but would stand together to adequately portray the events that took place. After interviewing each miner on site in Chile, Tobar has answered many questions the media held during the rescue effort, while also describing the struggle of group dynamics the miners faced while trapped inside. On August 6, the film adaptation of the book titled The 33 was released in Chile. In the U.S., it opens November 13th. It includes several famous actors, including Antonio Banderas and Juliette Binoche. Hector Tobar spoke at the Elie Bay Book Company on September 14th.
Tonight, we're so pleased to welcome Hector Tobar. He's the author of The Barbarian Nurseries, The Tattooed Soldier, and Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's worked with the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, among others, and he's currently a professor at the University of Oregon. So, almost local. We're here tonight to celebrate the paperback release of his latest book, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of the 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. I'm sure many of you followed the story on the news, as I did, and I'm so excited to hear more. It shows in great detail what it was like to be one of those 33 people trapped in the mine for 69 days in 2010. A movie's just been made about the book as well and about the event, of course. It's been released in Latin America and comes out in the U.S. in November, which is very exciting. I'm so excited to hear more. And I think that's everything. Thank you again so much for being here tonight, and please join me in welcoming Hector Tobar.
Thank you to the that's the beautiful sound of book buyers walking above us. Thank you to the Elliott Bay Book Company for this invitation. Thank you all for coming to this beautiful, important American bookstore and for supporting American book culture by coming here and buying books. I wanted to tell you a little bit about how this book came to be, and I'm going to read a few short passages that reflect different parts of the book and the people in it and the story it tells. This is the story of 33 men who were buried 2,000 feet underground, about the equivalent of a 200-story building. And many of you now, this is 5 years, have now passed. Many of you may remember seeing this unfold on television. I was one of you. I watched this unfold in television. I was at that time working in Los Angeles for the LA Times, and I did not cover the event. And so I saw this unfold on TV with no idea that I would one day be writing this book. And what happened was I got a call from my agent about 5 months after the rescue, after the men had been pulled out of this capsule, all 33 of them rescued from down below in the depths of the mine. And my agent said, Hector, would you be interested in writing the book of the Chilean miners? And I said, yes, I would, but do you have their rights? And he said, yes. And I said, how many of them? And he said, well, all 33. And what happened was that I did not know this, I would find it out much later as I began to write the book, was that when these 33 guys were all trapped underground, they were about to go up in a capsule, they were about to be rescued. You'll remember that it was this capsule that was maybe about a little bit wider than this podium, and they squeezed into it and were lifted up. But before the first man went up, they had a meeting in which they agreed that they would stick together, that it wasn't fair that some of them get money and others not for offers to give interviews or to write books, that they should all really write one book that would benefit all of them equally, and that would be the best way to honor their brotherhood, their unity underground. And so that's what they did. And so I went to Chile, to Copiapó, to meet these men. After getting the initial sort of okay from my agency and from the miners' lawyers. And I met them in a restaurant in Copiapó, and there was about 25 or 30 of them. And I said, gentlemen in Spanish, señores, you have lived the first great adventure of the 21st century. This is the Odyssey of our times. This is like Odysseus returning from Troy. This is a story that people are going to talk about for thousands of years, and it's my job to be your Homer. And that elicited 25 blank stares. But, you know, I took to heart the idea that my job in this work was to create a work of art. And for me, as a writer, to create art from human experience means you get close to human truths. And so my first job as a writer was to understand who these guys were and why they ended up there at the mine and how it was that their lives led to the mine, what mining work was like. And so I began to do many interviews. My first interviews were actually in that restaurant. My first was with a young man, Richard Villarroel, who it became apparent after 15 or 20 minutes of talking about his life that he was emotionally scarred by what had happened, that he had been trapped in a kind of hole. He had been trapped in this hole underground, had been tortured by the noise of the mountain's collapse, imagine an earthquake. We live in earthquake country here. Imagine living in an earthquake underground in the stone of a mountain, and that's what it was like. They saw the passages of the mine undulating, many horrific things. And in Richard's case, also, he had been trapped. He had seen this stone wall covering the only exit and thought his life was over while his girlfriend is pregnant with their first child. And for Richard, this was an especially painful idea that his son would grow up without ever knowing his father because Richard himself had never really known his father. Because when Richard was an adolescent, his father had died in an accident on a lake. He was a fisherman. Richard's father was from the southern part of Chile. He was a fisherman, and he had died on a lake. And so Richard had grown up really angry. As you know, it's hard to be a young person who loses a parent, who's separated from a parent. He was an angry young man. He had spent some time in jail for getting in fights. And so when he's trapped alive, he's in this room that's actually not much bigger than this, with passageways leading outside of it. It's dark. The light from his helmet is fading, and he's thinking, I'm going to die here, and I'm going to leave this little boy or little girl who's not been born yet with this lifelong hurt that I had. And so he was very, very still shaken up about that. And many of the men had stories of poverty, of overcoming poverty. And one of them was the one who would become sort of the most famous miner of all, Mario Sepulveda. Now, Mario, in the movie that's coming out on November 13th, it's going to be called The 33, based on this book, Mario is going to be played by Antonio Banderas. And so Mario is someone who is going to become a leader down below, even though he really isn't a leader. He is someone who just operates a front loader. He has no standing in the mining hierarchy. However, when the events unfold, he is going to step forward and help to keep the men together. So in this particular passage I'm going to read to you with a few little explanatory interruptions, this is the first time we meet Mario in the book. He lives in Santiago, which is several hours south of Copiapó. The city where the mine was located, the city closest to the mine, is in northern Chile, Copiapó, and it is several hours away from Santiago. In the intercity bus terminals in the center of Santiago, not far from Chile's presidential palace, many men set out for the San Jose mine. One is Mario Sepulveda, a frenetic father of two who has a reputation among his coworkers for pushing the front loader he operates too hard, thus forcing the mechanics to repair it repeatedly, and for talking too loud and too much, and for being generally unpredictable. On Wednesday afternoon, he sets out on the 500-mile journey from Santiago to the San Jose mine later than he should. There is a fair chance he won't make it to work on time. And in fact, he was several hours late. He was the last man to begin the shift. He snuck in so his boss wouldn't see him. Mario's nickname at the San Jose is Perry, which is short for perrito, the diminutive of the word perro or dog. Ask Mario why he's called Perry, and he'll tell you it's because he loves dogs. He owns two rescued strays at home, and because I have the heart of a dog. Tengo el corazón de perro. Like a dog, Mario is loyal, but if you try to hurt him, I'll bite you. He and his wife, Elvira, have two children, the first conceived in an impassioned encounter, quote, standing up against a pole, end quote. It's not very often that you have an interview subject tell you how he conceived his first child, and much less standing up against a pole. And I cut out a particular phrase here. He said, parados contra un poste a lo paraguayo, in the Paraguayan style, which I don't know exactly what that means. So that's Mario. Now they have a home on the fringes of Santiago, where his prized possession is a big meat locker, and where Mario's favorite place to sit is the small square-shaped table in his living room. He enjoys a hurried meal at the table with Elvira, his wife, and their teenage daughter, Scarlett, and their young son, Francisco, before leaving for the north. So Francisco is Mario's younger son, and they both are kind of short, Mario and his son. And because his son is short, and because Mario wants him to sort of have this idea of himself as a strong person, long before the disaster, they like to watch movies together with Mel Gibson. Because, as Mario explained, Mel Gibson is also short. So I wanted him to have a short hero. And so the movie they most like is Braveheart. Okay. And so when Mario becomes trapped, he wants his son to remember these Braveheart stories, that like Braveheart, he will be reunited with his son. The other thing about Mario's self, even before this accident happens, is that he is someone with an image of himself as a survivor. He's someone, he told me that his mother died delivering him. And that he grew up frenetic. His wife told me that he has a diagnosis of being bipolar. And so he takes medication to control his emotions, except that when he got trapped, he was no longer taking it, which will later explain many of the things that happen underground. And so Mario is someone who is a survivor, a fighter, someone who never gives up. And that will be important in what happens next, because the men are working underground, and this particular mine is very old. It's more than 100 years old. And it's sort of like a whole history lesson unto itself. The top of the mine, I describe it in the book as an iceberg city, because you can see one building at the top of the mine, but below that, underground, there are 2,000 feet vertically of passageways. And in fact, the passageway to the bottom of the mine is a spiral and sometimes zigzag highway that takes four or 5 miles long, because it's at a 10% grade. So the top of the mine is a building from the 19th century, and the 21st century part of the mine is at the bottom. And what happens is they've emptied out this mine of copper and gold ore for 115 years. So when you do that, you leave empty spaces. So there is an empty space in the mine, an abyss that they call the pit, El Rajo. And that empty space is floating above this hard granite stone that is the heart of the mountain. But eventually, there is so much empty space carved out, the mountain starts to weaken. It's structurally weak. The men can hear that the mountain is starting to give way in the weeks before the collapse. They hear the mine making noises. It begins to make this thundering sound because there are rock avalanches in the part of the mine that's been excavated because the mine is weakening, and they can hear this thunder. It turns out sound travels faster through stone than it does through the air, and so they can hear this thunder traveling through the mountain, and they know it's weakening. And then finally, on August 5th, a little bit after 1 p.m., when the men should be at lunch, but because this mine is so disorganized, it's owned by these two brothers, so the safety is so poor. Everything is so informal, as they say in Spanish, informal. The men are late for their lunch. And so they're still waiting for the lunch truck to come down when the mountain collapses on top of them. The structure of the mountain collapses, and it knocks out the layers of this ramp one by one. And it causes like this earthquake. Many of the men are already at, because it's the lunch hour, and the lunch hour, they wait for the lunch truck at this place called the Refuge, which is a room about half as big as this one, which is has some steel mesh around it and a steel door in front, and it's sort of protection in case the rest of the mountain collapses. It's sort of intended to sort of hold together more. So they run to this room, they wait for this thunder outside to stop, and then they try to run out to see if they can make it to the surface. But each time they do that, the thunder starts anew, the collapse starts anew. So I'm going to read to you a short passage describing what that was like. The men who were at the refuge tried to escape on foot during lulls in the explosions. After a first attempt ends with a retreat back to the refuge, they try again, only to find the rumbling of an underground earthquake beginning anew. The solid rock of the mountain is transformed into a breathing, pulsating mass. The ceiling and floor of the ramp become undulating waves of stone, and the mountain hurls boulders that emerge from the blackness of the tunnel and roll and bounce downhill, each a lethal weapon aimed at their bodies. We were a pack of sheep, and the mountain was about to eat us, Jose Ojeda later says. For Victor Zamora, another miner, the sound of exploding rock feels like machine gun fire aimed at him and his fellow miners. It's too much, too scary, too dangerous. So they start running back downhill, but it's as if they were running on a bridge swaying in the wind, one of the miners says. Luis Arzúa and Florencio Avalos, two of the mining supervisors, arrive at this moment and see this group of panicked men running toward their pickup truck. The mine is so big that these vehicles drive around down there. That's the main way. So there's 18 vehicles down there, and the supervisor drives a pickup truck. They watch these supervisors mesmerized as another blast wave rushes through the tunnel. It seems to pick up Alex Vega, the smallest and slightest of the miners, and lifts him up off his feet as if he were some miner-shaped kite that caught a sudden gust of wind. Others are knocked over, falling, flailing at the air. They stumble, these big men in overalls, men with bodies shaped by red wine and beers and backyard barbecues, babied by their wives and mothers and mothers-in-law. The blast knocks Victor Zamora against the wall of the ramp, face first, knocking out some of the teeth he was born with and a few others that a dentist made for him, adding a sharper pain to the already dull, lingering pain of a rotted molar. When he and the others see the supervisor's pickup truck, they rise to their feet and rush toward it. Zamora squeezes his dust-covered body and bloody mouth into the narrow seat behind the driver, and the pickup truck tries to drive to the surface. So many of these men cram into this pickup truck. The last guys are holding on to the legs of the guys in the back who are standing in the back in the cab of the bed of the pickup truck, and they start driving towards the surface to see if they can get out. They get up a few turns of the spiral, and suddenly they see a brand new wall blocking the way out. And what it is, it's a piece of the mountain that has collapsed down several levels and is now blocking the way. Now, this is something totally outside of their experience in mining. Many of these guys are in their 40s and 50s. They've worked in mines forever. They've seen small avalanches that take like a few hours to clear with a bulldozer. But this is, one of the miners described it to me as a guillotine of stone. Another guy said it was like the stone they put in front of Jesus' tomb, you know. It was brand new. Like, the mine is dirty. It has all this soot on it. But this wall is clean. You know, it's just been cut from the mountain. And so this really freaks them out, especially the older guys who say, we're screwed. This is the end of our lives. And so they begin to get very desperate. Several things happen that the world does not know about. One group of men goes back down to the refuge, and they're hungry. It's by now 4 or 5 in the afternoon, usually the hour at which they'd be cleaning up and getting ready for dinner. Then it's 7, 8. They decide, you know what, we're not going to wait. We're hungry. Break open that cabinet with the supplies. The other guys say, look, the leaders, the other guys are up there trying to find a way out. We have to wait. The guys who are hungry went out with a threat of violence, and they break open the cabinet, and four or five guys steal a good portion of the emergency supplies. What are the emergency supplies? Cookies. Or like Oreo-style cookies. A few cans of tuna, some industrial water, some clean water. They have only a few bottles of actual fresh water. And so right away, there's this division and this sense of desperation. The situation could very easily have devolved into a sort of Lord of the Flies, except for two or three men who stepped forward. One was Juan Carlos Aguilar, who was a contract mechanic. Another was Florencio Avalos, who was number two in charge. Luis Ursúa, the guy supposed to be in charge, he doesn't do anything. He says, this is beyond me. I take off my white helmet, symbol of his authority. I'm no longer in charge. Stepping into this void is another person, is Mario Sepúlveda, who says, look, we have to remain united. We're going to try to find a way out of here. We're going to try to send the signal to the top. We have to divide our food. We have to ration it. And the men begin to organize themselves. And they decide that every day they're going to have one meal of one cookie. First they have two cookies a day. Then later becomes one cookie a day. And then becomes one cookie every 2 days. For the first 17 days, they begin to lose weight. And so the men live this period of being sort of living their own deaths very slowly. So you can imagine, what it's like to be trapped somewhere where you are allowed to think about your own death for several days. So the men begin to feel it's a judgment. Others feel, just a sense of sorrow that their family is going to have to continue without them. Meanwhile, on the surface, their families arrive at the mine and begin to organize themselves and to pressure the government to rescue the men. But on the surface, the stories are really complicated. These guys are like any other working class guys or just men in general. Their loves and their libidos and their poor decisions and the money they have, it all adds up for some of them to some complicated relationships. And so in the case of one guy, Yoni Barrios, he will become famous later as the guy whose wife and mistress fight on the surface. Now, Yoni isn't to all appearances much of a catch. He's someone, he's got a kind of a belly, a paunch, he's got, kind of ruddy skin, but he somehow or another is a neighborhood Romeo. And so when word arrives at his, when word spreads on the on the surface of the mountain, these two women who are there, the press covers this immediately and says, Marta and Susana, Marta is his wife, Yoni is his girlfriend, they found out about each other at the mine. They discovered each other's presence in the mine. That is speculation. It wasn't true. As I found out in about 10 minutes, these women knew about each other for many years. And so I'm going to describe here what happens, sort of a little bit of the background of their stories. Marta, Johnny's wife, is a much smaller, older, more severe, and serious woman than Susana. Susana, I don't describe her quite here, but she's a larger woman, very pink skin. I interviewed her the first time with a member of the movie production team with me, the screenwriter Jose Rivera. After we had spoken with her, she was so funny and bubbly and full of life and crying and yelling. Jose told me, Susana, she's like a character from a Fellini movie. So there's Marta, who's kind of severe, and there's Susana, who's boisterous, who's the girlfriend. These two women have known each other for several years, as Yoni has bounced back and forth between their two homes. Susana first met Yoni in his wife's house. She mentioned to Marta that she needed someone to build some furniture. This ugly old man I live with, my husband, he made that over there, Marta said. I'm bored of him. Yoni then emerged from the room where his wife had him prisoner, in quotes, or so Susana tells it. Marta explains that she's endured his philandering for years. Susana thinks, this guy isn't ugly at all. In his sad, lonely smile, there is a hint of sly cunning. The come-hither look of a wounded man who wants to open his soul to you right now, as soon as you can slip away and be alone with him. I brought him over here and I liked him, Susanna says, and I made him a little lunch, and then we made a little love afterwards. He never did make the furniture. Now this history is a light and comical prologue to the tragedy of this same philandering man buried and lost in the San Jose mine. When she learns of the accident from her husband's mistress, Martha responds in a rather bloodless tone, "This is as far as you go with him. Now I'm in charge. Go get me the marriage book." The libreta de matrimonio is a kind of passbook signed by the official who performs a civil marriage ceremony, and it's used to apply for a variety of government services and also to gain places, gain access to places where only a spouse will be admitted. For example, a hospital room or a coroner's office. The document is in Yoni's possession at Susana's house. Susana obediently retrieves her boyfriend's marriage book, and together she and his wife head off to the hospital. So these complicated family lives all are transferred to the top of the San Jose mine. And so we have this dual drama. And I discovered, occurred to me after my first set of interviews that what I was really dealing with here was a love story. That this story was about men who wanted to go home, back to the families that they had, to the wives of the girlfriends, their daughters, to their children, because that was the best thing about them, best thing about their lives. They wanted to just go home. And it was a story about the women on the surface organizing themselves, trying to recreate the routines of family life as they waited for these men to be rescued or to be found dead. And so on the surface, the families begin to gather, and it's first kind of chaotic. One particular woman comes from Antofagasta, which is many hundreds of miles away. She comes because her little brother is in the mine. They're both in their 50s, but they grew up very poor, and she's always the one who takes charge in a crisis. So she comes to the mine. She sets up her tent at the gate, front gate, and she's the closest to the front gate. And so whenever someone brings something, some wood, here, we have firewood for the families, she accepts it. Very quickly, she becomes known as the leader. She becomes known as la alcaldesa, the mayor. So she becomes a very strong leader, a woman who is leading the families. In the film, she's going to be played by Juliette Binoche. The real Maria Segovia is a shortish woman, 54, very dark skin, about 4 feet 10, and then Julia Binoche is Julia Binoche. But that's Hollywood. And so from Maria Segovia and many of the other women that I interviewed, a portrait emerged of this community and of these women and relatives who loved men who they knew were flawed. And we were all flawed. But a miner is especially flawed in these macho, ways very often. And so the story unfolds. And the men are found, finally. After 17 days, a drill breaks through to where they are. It's a moment of national celebration. In Chile, everybody knows where they were when they got the news of the men being found. And then another 52 days pass while they are being rescued. Because the first drill that breaks through is about the size, not much bigger than a fist. It's just big enough to lower food to them. First thing they lower down to them is a telephone line to them to talk to the surface. Is everybody okay? Yes, we're okay. Da-da-da-da-da. They send down glucose capsules. Then the men begin to eat more. But then they also send down the mail. They send down letters from the family members on the surface. And very soon, the men begin to realize that these men who had gone to work in one of the worst places to work in Chile, who were considered to be, even in the mining community, to be kind of like outcasts or second-class citizens. In fact, the guys who worked at that mine were called kamikazes because it was so dangerous to work at. That these guys who have this really lousy job, they've suddenly become the most famous miners on Earth. and they get newspaper newspaper coverage of themselves. They lower down a fiber optic cable, and they connect it to a television. Now I asked the rescuers, how did you get a television 2,000 feet underground through a tube that's 4 or 5 inches in diameter? Oh, Mr. Tobar, in those days we could ask for anything we wanted, and Samsung has a little television that is about as big as an iPhone. It's a projector, so it just projects the image onto a sheet. So we sent them the television, they had a sheet, and they watched TV. So they saw themselves every day on the Chilean equivalent of the Today Show, And so this changed the whole dynamic underground, because these guys who would banded together, prayed every day for God to save them so they can be reunited with their families, are suddenly thinking, I'm going to be rich. Right away, a Chilean entrepreneur promised them all $10,000, and he gave it to them. The check was presented to their families while they were still trapped. He also said that he wanted Chile to raise $1 million for each of them so they would never have to work again. So they begin to believe they've won the lottery while they're trapped underground. So some of them begin, for example, to say, honey, can you send me, with the money we're going to get, can you send me down some brochures? So I think I might want to buy a car. But honey, you don't have a driver's license. Can you please send me the manual for studying for the driver's test? So these guys who are trapped underground, waiting for the world to save them, start studying how to make a left turn and what the rules are if you encounter a horse on the highway in Chile. And so things like that. And it became, the story was this other absurd kind of strange story that I didn't expect to find. At the same time, the mountain is still rumbling. It's still threatening to collapse upon them. They become divided, but they realize they have to sort of still stick together. And eventually they're pulled out. Now, you'll remember, as I said before, this capsule that's a little bit wider than this podium is lowered down to bring them out one at a time. And this was still a moment of a lot of tension, because they had to be taken up the equivalent of 200 stories through this stone cavity that had been cut in the mountain. The mountain is still rumbling. It's as unstable as they say the fault is here in the Northwest, somebody told me. And so, it's this unstable sort of, seismic thing that's still alive. And so Maria Segovia said, we were really nervous, because when they were coming up through this thing, it's like the mountain was going to give birth to them. And Mr. Tobar, that giving birth is never easy. Maria Segovia, 54-year-old great-grandmother, she knows a little bit about childbirth. She knows sometimes the baby gets stuck in the canal, and that could have happened. These men are coming up through this channel that's been cut into the mountain. The capsule could have gotten stuck and killed somebody. He could have died there. And so the men themselves, another woman told me, when her husband finally came up, he's this, old man in his mid-50s, white hair, sandpaper skin, that when he came out all squeezed like that, the first thing she did was she touched him, and she touched his whole body to see if he was all there, in the same way that you touch a baby, to see if a baby is whole. And so that was this really powerful metaphor of rebirth. And to complete that metaphor of rebirth, a couple of the guys told me, when I came up in that capsule, it took 40 minutes, or 30, for the first guy, 40 minutes. Later, they did a little bit faster. He said, I had a lot of time to think, and I was going through this thing, and my life flashed before me. I thought about all of the things that had happened to me when I was trapped. I thought about the prayers we said. I thought about when I met my wife and our first kids were born. And so this whole sense of being reborn is there in the story for the men as they're rising up in this capsule and then coming out into the world. They come out into the world, they are suddenly famous, but they don't want to tell their story yet. And the Chilean media eventually got very angry with them and began to treat them like reality television stars. Why won't you tell us? What did you do underground? Did you masturbate? Did you think of eating someone? Did you have sex underground? All these different things. And so the men became very, and then people started asking them for money. Can you lend me money for my roof is leaking, cousin? Hey, brother, my daughter, your niece is sick. Can you lend me some money? And so it became a very different, the book describes that. But in the end, what sort of heals the men are two things. Time heals the scars of being trapped, and family, the routines of family, of going back to a job and then coming home in the afternoon and coming home to your steak with avocado, a very popular dish, or to a soup your wife makes, coming back and, you know, seeing your kids sit at the table and tell you about their studies. You know, it's a simple thing. But those things in the end are what heal the men of the San Jose mine. And like the Odyssey, which is a story about Ulysses trying to get back home and undergoing all these trials and tribulations just to get back to Ithaca and to his wife, these men underwent many trials and tribulations. The monster of the mountain threatened to kill them. They heard the siren song of riches that awaited them that turned out not to be true. And they found out that getting home itself was its own reward. And so that's the story of what happened in the San Jose mine. And with that, I will take your questions. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the author? Yes. About four or five of them did, yes. In fact, one guy recently who told me that he did it and it caused him to have too much stress and he had to stop doing it. I think most of the guys that I've talked to went back underground. At first, it made them feel better. They sort of felt like they belonged there. But then later, reliving this, you know, it's a very sensual, this experience of being, you know, in the dark and with the noises and the stone walls, it was too much and they had to stop doing it, yeah. Another question? Yes.
What are the two most contrasting viewpoints you have from people, from the miners, after the end and
yes.
the success and all of that?
The most contrasting viewpoints are about Mario Sepulveda. Mario is, for many of the miners, when I first met them, they said, look, we survived thanks to one person, to Mario Sepulveda. I will say it for the rest of my life because I'm not an ingrate, because he actually saved our lives. And another group of men, maybe a smaller group of men, believe that Mario was a vain person who almost sold off his own story and betrayed his fellow miners, who has become famous at their expense. And they also point out, as I point out in the book, that for every moment that he was a leader and charismatic, he was out of control. He threatened a couple of guys to have fights. One of the miners told me when I went to bed every night, when I went to sleep, I slept with a wrench next to me to defend myself in case this guy attacked me. And so there was, you know, this real sharp divisions about him. There's another sort of set of discontent with the man who was supposed to be in charge, who did take charge of many things, Luis Ursúa, who became known during the rescue as the great leader because he was supposed to be in charge and because he was the one who first answered the telephone, he was the one who talked to the president. But many of the men pointed out to me that during those first 17 days, they believe he abdicated his responsibility. So many of them, the first thing they wanted me to say was that Luis Ursúa was not the leader. There's a lot of discontent and divisions about them. So these sort of personal politics things, which, you know, are in the book, that's really a lot of what, and I think it's just really understandable given human nature that there would be those kinds of differences and divisions. Yes. Another question? Yes.
What happened to Panilla, the man that was supposed to be the manager and very definitely seemed to know what was going on and then
right.
had the
Yeah, Carlos Pinilla is in the book, and you obviously read it. Thank you, right? He is the general manager of the mine. And so he was above Luis Ursúa, and he went down to the mine that day and heard many of the men make complaints. Hey, the mountain's making a lot of noises. He said, oh, no, don't worry. It's just the mine's just settling. It's always settling. And he drove out. At one point, he was driving toward the surface. He got a flat tire. And as some of the men recounted, in a panic, insisted that several miners fix his flat tire so he could drive out of the mine. And then a few hours later, the mine collapses. So I interviewed Carlos Pinilla at length, and he hasn't suffered any criminal penalties. What he has suffered is the shame of being someone cast as the villain in the story. You know, one of the things that did come out publicly is the miners testifying before Congress about what happened on that day and painting out this man to be the villain of the story, as a person who betrayed them. Carlos Pinilla told me, there's no way. I thought the mine was going to collapse that day. I thought it had 20 more years left in it. And he said, look, when those guys were trapped, I was destroyed. I felt horrible. I thought, those guys are going to die down there, and I'm the son of a bitch who sent them down there, you know. And he used those words exactly. And when they were found, it was the happiest day of my life, happier than the days when my daughters got married, you know. And he seemed extremely contrite. He said, I've changed. I no longer boss people around the way I used to. I say thank you and please, you know, because that's the portrait of him in the book and of the miners. So I think he was someone who, he told me, he could no longer look for work in his hometown, Copiapó, because he felt ostracized by people in the mining community. I don't know if that's punishment enough, but that's what happened to him. Yes. Another question? Yes, in the back. Yes, you may. I guess the book says to, yeah, no, nobody, I'm looking at the cover. No, they all came out alive. They did all come out alive. Yes. Yes. Over here, ma'am. Oh, yes. Well, that's kind of... No, that's kind of conflating several different kind of things that happened. I think that there was a time when several of them stopped getting up from the floor of the refuge where they were sleeping. And that might be, first of all, due to just hunger. You know, hunger makes you lethargic after a number of days. There were a lot of guys who were not very religious who began to pray with the group because of the extreme nature of the situation. And there was another time when they were all fighting and divided, and Mario went down to the bottom of the mine to pray for the unity of the men, and I'm going to describe this a little bit backwards in the way it's described in the book. Something happened to him down there. He comes up to the top of the back up higher where all the other men are, and he's covered in soot and mud. And they asked him, Mario, what happened to you? And he said, I was fighting with the devil. And so I heard this story, like many stories I heard about Mario, not from Mario himself, even though I had interviewed him for the longest I interviewed anybody. And I said, Mario, I heard this story that you fought with the devil. What is that about? And, well, first of all, by that time I found out that there's a legend in Chile, and maybe it's in many other countries, that the devil lives in gold mines. So there's that's one thing. So Mario, he had this, by the time this happened, he had already become famous around the world. He was already on the cover of the New York Daily News, the New York Post, because what made him famous was that he had shot a video where he described to the rescuers on the surface what the conditions were like, and he interviewed all the men. And then he made a speech about how we're going to get out of here, we're going to survive, don't worry about us, we are not like the miners you think, we're intelligent people, and it was really moving. So that made him famous. And so Mario realized when that happened that he had a gift of speaking. So he would go down to the bottom of this place in the mine, where later he would encounter the devil, and he would do two things. He would pray, and he would practice his speeches, because he knew that one day he was going to be, you know, that was going to be his calling. And so he goes down to this place to either practice his speech or to pray, depending on what, you know, version of the story you hear. And all of a sudden, he says, God, you know, take this insect out of our brains, because the insect, meaning the devil, is dividing us. And he said, at that moment, I felt a hot breath on the back of my neck, you know, and I turned around and all I saw was darkness. Well, it's not unusual, you know, the temperature there is 90 degrees, you know, normally, sometimes 105, the humidity is 90%. It isn't outside of like the realm of the expected that a hot something would blow on the back of his neck. But to him, it was a hot breath. And he turns around, he sees nothing, and then he looks and he sees there's a pool of water, because water's coming to the mine from the drills. They drill, and there's water flowing into the mine. He sees a pool of water, and he sees the eyes, these eyes of a monstrous person, himself, reflected in the water, yeah. Right? And that startles him, the sight of himself. As he's like in this, you know, moment of just extreme stress building, a rock falls in this space. Now, this is a part of the mine that's been excavated before. There have been rock falls before. There's always rocks falling. So once again, it's a sort of not unusual thing that a rock would fall. But those three things together, or four things, the fact that he's praying to get rid of the devil, he feels a breath on the hot breath on the back of his neck, he sees his reflection on the water, and he sees a huge slab of rock fall not far from him, he becomes convinced the devil's down there. So he starts yelling into the darkness, devil, I'm not going to be your son, I'll never be your son, and he starts picking up rocks and throwing them in the darkness, believing the devil is there. So he works himself up into this frenzy in which he believes he's fighting the devil. So maybe it was a story like that that you heard, you know? And so I piece this together from interviewing Mario, who tells it really in a beautiful way. And so I think that might have been one of the things that people were, that you might be remembering or thinking about. Who knows? Okay, another question. Yes. Separated from what? Yes. Oh, well, they were all separated from the surface. They were all separated from the surface. Yeah, there were different levels, and they slept in different areas. But no, I think you might have misunderstood. I didn't really. None of them was ever really. There was a few who tried to find ways out, but there was never anybody. They many of them, not all of them, went into this room called the refuge to hide because they were so scared from what they had lived through. And so they slept there all the time. Another group of men said they didn't want to do that. They slept in a hut because it started to smell really bad. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they all, but those who were by themselves, they found the group and they all sort of got together and tried to find their way out. Yes. No, there were people who tried to climb out through these tunnels. But no, not to the other, not the other parts of the mind. No. Another question? Yes, in the back, yes.
What's fascinating about the mirror in the crack?
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes, it's also in the movie, by the way. The movie's due out November 13th. And, you know, this mountain is unstable. It's falling apart even before the accident. And so one way that you can tell if these rocks are shifting in a crack is you put a mirror in the crack. And so if the mirror breaks, then you know that these slabs of rock are moving in opposite directions, which would indicate that the structure of the mine has been compromised. And so at the insistence of several of the miners who actually went on a wildcat strike one day and said, we're not going to work until you tell us what's going on with these cracks, they installed these mirrors, and the mirrors never did crack. Now, Jorge Gallegos, who is one of the whistleblowers in the mine and someone who was older guy, he was always on top of this. He told me he believed that they were maybe switching the mirrors out, you know. So I don't know if that's true, but he believed that might be the case. So that's what these mirrors were for. And so they do appear in the film momentarily. Yeah, you see that. Yeah. Another question? Yes?
Did a world celebrity ever turn up at the site to bring attention and funds?
Yes, did world celebrities? Yes, many, many, many. World and mostly like Latin American celebrities. You remember those guys who were trapped in the Andes in the snow and ended up eating each other, they showed up at the mic. And assorted singers. One of my favorite stories that I heard was that this particular, you know, we have a tradition here of the mariachis in northern Mexico, you know, the guy. Well, mariachis are also really popular in Chile. So this one particular mariachi band shows up at the mine to give sal, you know, and they're, you know, and they all are there to show the families that they're with them. They pose for pictures. So one of the women whose husband is down below trapped, she poses with a picture for these band members, and they all put their arms around her, and they pose for a picture. And she sends this picture down in the letter to her husband. And her husband gets this, and he is furious. He says, "I don't want to see you in pictures with other men, and much less them touching you." And she tells me, you know, he was always a little jealous. But when he was trapped down there, he got even more jealous. So yeah, there were celebrities from all over the place. And there was NASA people who showed up. And at one point for me, one quick really weird detail was that, you know, Luis Ursula told me they kept on putting people on the phone for me to talk to. Because, you know, he's on the phone. And one day it was the ambassador from Palestine, you know. And it was like, and he's like, "Hello." And then the next day, it was the ambassador from Israel. I was like, "Wow, that's yeah, that was, yeah, yes, ma'am, yes."
Any divorces?
Oh. Any divorces? There were some guys who, for example, Ariel Ticona, who's at the end of the book, he had his wife was pregnant with their third child when he got trapped. So he had promised her before, "Look, I missed the first two deliveries. This time I'll be there." Okay? So he's trapped. And so he's not going to get out in time. He's going to miss the delivery. So this is absolutely surreal. You could never make this up. So they decide he's not going to make the delivery because they're not, you know, they're still trapped. So they use this fiber optic cable and they send him a video of the birth. So he is, as far as I know, the first man in human history to witness the birth of his child while trapped 2,000 feet underground. So when he gets out, you know, this story is known in the media. And so he's invited to Spain, where the Spanish media invite him to on a talk show, kind of, you know, like Oprah or something. And he and his wife are sitting with the baby who's now been born, you know, in Madrid in the TV studio. And they said, "Ariel, we have a surprise for you." And they roll out this brand new, like, $500 stroller, you know, it's rolled out by the starlet, you know, typical Spanish European television. And she's like walking in her high heels and walking. Everybody's cheering. Yay, yay, yay. So Ariel, you know, it becomes famous as the guy whose child was born while he was underground. He moves back. He goes back home. After all begins to die down, he has to go back to work. And he gets really angry. He doesn't even know why he's angry. It's post-traumatic stress, you know. And he this man who longed to be back home with his wife begins to fight with her. And this happened a lot. You know, guys who were homebodies, they suddenly felt like they didn't belong at home, you know. And so he begins to fight with his wife. He moves out of his house. So he spent 2 or 3 weeks out of the home. He got another job, and eventually he moved back in. But many of the men had these, you know, marital, which is so common. We've all seen this. Now, during the accident itself, some other very odd things happened. Many guys promised that they would marry their longtime girlfriends, and several of them did. One guy, Franklin Lobos, he is a great person to have trapped down there because he had been famous before. Okay, he had been a soccer star in Chile, and he was a soccer star in that town of Copiapó. But by now, when the accident happened, he was in his early 40s. His career was over. He was now driving a taxi in Copiapó and the truck they got trapped down below. That's how his life had gone downhill. He told these guys, "Look," when they were found, "we're going to be famous, but fame doesn't last. It never lasts. Always fades. I've seen it in my life." But he said, "Nah, they wouldn't listen to me because you have to live it." So Franklin, in the middle of all this, he'd always been kind of a hard-headed guy. He had been a womanizer. He had left his wife. He said, I left my wife when I was womanizing because I just felt bad for her, you know, that I was putting her through this, so I got divorced, which in Chile was hard to do because the divorce wasn't legal until 2005. But he got divorced anyways. And when the accident happens, his ex-wife comes to the mind because she's the, you know, he's the father of her children, and she wants to sort of show solidarity with the rest of the family, and they begin to talk, and, you know, and the relatives are saying, or the, you know, his nieces and nephews, you know, oh, Uncle Franklin, you know, Doña Maria, I forgot her name, but she's up there. And she's like there every day. You should talk to her. And they start to talk on the phone. And as a result of him being trapped in the mine, he remarried his ex-wife. So, you know, there it was all sorts of things like that. I mean, I couldn't even catalog them all, but many of those stories are in the book. Yes. Thanks. Yes. I think that, what do I know of the PTSD? I think that the Chilean government really kind of blew it, that they did this really incredible effort to rescue these guys, but they had a group of people who had were facing a unique psychological crossroads because they had been trapped longer than anybody else in history. They were guys who faced this mine that was sort of, you know, rumbling, and it was a really traumatic experience. And then there are celebrities. And so the combination of all those things was just too much for anybody to deal with. So I think there was a much higher level of PTSD. You know, PTSD normally only affects like 10 or 15% of people who go into a battlefield situation, for example, or some really low figure. And in the case of this, of the San Jose mine, it may have been as high as 75%, you know. And so my experience with this was that just about every guy had a crisis. Some of them had it like the first few weeks, and many of them had it 3 years later. Maybe not all of them, but most of them did. And so they received the treatment any worker in Chile would receive, where you get the government will pay for you to go see a psychologist. Many of them were pronounced okay when they clearly weren't. So I think that there should have been some coordinated effort to make sure that they got the treatment they needed. Having said that, I think over time, most of them are okay, even though recently I went to L.A. and I met with Mario Sepulveda and Carlos Barrios, who's the new head of the Miners Committee. And he told me that, you know what, I was fine for 4 years and all of a sudden it just hit me. And I'm on disability right now. I'm not working. So, wow, you know. I mean, I think it can just happen with something that's really traumatic like that. Yeah. I think I have time for two more questions. So, in the back over there.
As an author or storyteller, did you feel beholden or burdened being accountable to 33 individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really great question. Thank you for asking it. I felt like, first of all, that I had to have at least... And I had to have each of them in the book at least once. You know, it's like if I were trapped down below and some, you know, American guy wrote my story, you know, and he didn't mention my name even once, I would be pretty upset. So I wanted to mention all of them once. And of course, a lot of people have complained, no, there are too many names in the book. And so now if you buy the paperback, there is a dramatis personae in the front. And there's more pictures, and there's pictures, and there's a map. So, but yeah, that was a concern of mine, was that I tried to, and also I could have very easily just written the story about Mario and had everybody else be a supporting cast, but that wouldn't have been true to what I sort of knew. And so I felt a lot of responsibility to cover. Then there were also, it became clear to me there were different kind of groups of guys. There were the young guys. Many times they hung out together. When I interviewed them, they would never come by themselves. It was like they'd always come like in two or threes, like for moral support of each other, the young guys. And the older guys, they would sit and talk alone with me, and they would cry. And then there were the guys from the south, and then the guys from the north. And so there were just many different kinds of people, and I felt they all had sort of different unique experiences, and they all remember different things. I found out, like, if we all experienced something here together, we could all have it, you know, etched in our minds, but we'd all remember something different about it, you know? Because that's the way memory works. And so I felt really blessed to have so many guys. Now, the other thing is that I had total control of the story. So I felt like I was the ultimate arbiter of truth in the story. Now, I know that that's impossible for someone to be totally, you know, like perfect about it, and I know I've made some mistakes, but I feel like I tried the best I could to arrive at the truth as I sort of best could understand it. You know, so for example, there were only a few moments when I had different versions that were like mutually incompatible of the same event. One of the most famous, and it became famous even before my book was written, in the days afterwards, was that when the men were trapped, there should have only been like 25 of them, or 20 or so. But it turned out, as they're counting, 30, 31, 32, 33. And to a lot of the guys, that really freaked them out. And several of the men claimed, three different guys told me that they were the ones who yelled out, "The age of Christ, la edad de Cristo," which was like this kind of like, oh, you know, and the Catholic or, you know, evangelical guys, that's a freaky number, you know. And so, you know, I was the one who said that. So, well, I was going to just say A minor shouted until towards the end of the process, I interviewed this guy, Juan Yanis. And he is someone who doesn't like Mario Sepulveda, you know. Mario basically became this famous person. Juan did a lot of things underground. He was actually elected to be their spokesperson while they were still underground, and he was a spokesperson for one press conference, but then sort of the media forgot about him. So he doesn't like Mario. And he told me, I told him this. I said, yeah, I have a lot of different people telling me that they were the ones who said 33, the age of Christ. And he said, Mario said it. I'll never forget it. He said, la edad de Cristo, mierda. The age of Christ. And I thought, that has to be true. That just rang true to me, you know? And so that is what I didn't say, you know, like in journalism, very often you hedge, you say, well, two different sources said this, one source, nah, I'm going to take charge of the story. That is what happened. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. So there weren't that many instances where I had to do that. Usually, you know, there were differences. For example, Luis Ursúa wasn't the leader. Well, he would tell you, yes, it's true, I took off my white helmet, but he has his rationalization for it. But that's not a conflict. That's two different ways of understanding the same event, you know. So, but I didn't have to make that many decisions. But so, yeah, there was, I felt I had total control of the story, and I'm grateful as a writer. And I think it serves the story better. Yes. Last question? Anybody? Yeah. Yes. Okay, yes.
I'm sorry. Did you take lots of notes? Did you have a reporter?
Yes. Did I take lots of notes? Well, I am the world's most disorganized reporter. I've been a reporter for 25 years, and I lose things right away. Fortunately, I had, in this instance, a lot of help. First of all, I had a digital recorder, and I had this wonderful instrument called a computer. And so I downloaded all my interviews onto this computer. And then I was working at the same time with the movie people. So if you see the movie, I was involved with that even before a word was written of the screenplay. And so, but the movie people had lots of resources. So they took my interviews and said, Hector, can we have your interviews? We'll transcribe them for you. So they transcribed hundreds of pages of interviews in Spanish. And I can tell there's a lot of people here who've done that and know how laborious that is. So I had very soon, I had these digital files of the transcriptions. So, for example, if I was trying to remember when the guy talked about beer, I could search all 500 pages for cerveza, and I'd find the references to cerveza. And so that helped a lot. So I had a lot of people helping me, and I had 3 years. It took me 3 years to work on it, and I tried to be really disciplined, and I had a great editor. So it takes a village to write a book, and in this case, I had a village and the 33 men, so I had a lot of help. So thank you all for coming, and I'll be there to sign books. Thank you. And to answer more questions, too, if you have any.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Hector Tobar is the author of Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine, and the Miracle That Set Them Free. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on September 14th, 2015. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Anna Tatashev.